A podcast of the cinema.
Says you.
I do. I'm Alonzo Duralde. You're Dave White. We are film critics, and this is our show.
Yes. We continue to be in the catching up game.
I think that's just going to be our,
that's sort of
our
where we're
state
at now.
Of being for the
it's
time being.
It's going to be this way for a while, yeah, until... The thing I talk about all the time, too much every time, the surgery, that makes me always running late on the hamster wheel.
Yeah.
And
so maybe we just stop saying that and just plow.
Like it's kind of like apologizing for the weird sound quality
of, yes,
sometimes.
Yes. we broke you of that one. Let's just plow on in, and you know.
You're right. You're correct.
There's a lot of cinema
out
there.
No more. Yeah, there's so much cinema. No one could ever keep up anyway.
Heavens no.
I mean, there's not a lot of good cinema. But there is...
Well, there's at least a couple things we're talking about next time that I think are...
Oh, no, there's stuff we're talking about this time that's great.
Okay, well...
Yeah, no. I mean, there's... Let me look at a document. I tend to like... Well, no. Everything we're talking about this week is pretty good.
Okay, then.
And one of them is medium good.
Okay.
No pukey barf today. No barf of puke. Not like that. What was that movie? That was that Hallmark movie you were watching.
Which,
like, I don't know. You said that the night you were watching some. You said to me, I was on my way to bed, and you said, I can't think anymore today. I've just got to watch something on Hallmark. It was an old.
Oh yeah, it was one of the evergreen movies.
Oh my God.
It was not meant for your eyes.
Like, I hate all those movies. Like, hate them. Hate them. But that one, the 10 minutes or so that passed in front of my eyes, I just thought, I've hit a new level of disbelief that something could be this. I'm not going to, well, I was going to say a swear, but
no.
You know, we don't do that on this show. We're very clean.
Yes, Dave, we all know you're too cool for Hallmark.
It's not about too cool. It's never been about too cool. It's about, like, I like Christmas too much to accept this stuff. Also, it's April, so I wouldn't be watching a Christmas movie anyway.
Yes.
That's your demented behavior.
Yes.
It's unbelievable.
There is a part in that movie that involves an ice skating rink with a footbridge over it. That
sure.
It's one of the best locations they've ever found for one of these things.
Yeah.
It is so cozy and Christmassy. But yeah,
it's April.
A lot of that movie is nonsense.
It's April.
Again, these are things I put on. You'll note, you didn't even mention that I had it on mute. I just, it was...
Well, lucky you. You didn't have to listen to the...
It was a little bit of just a wallpaper for my eyes as I was winding down from the day. Would you rather I watch a Netflix original featuring Adam Sandler?
I'm going to just talk about my own silliness here for a minute. It is no dumber of you to watch those things than it is for me to hang out on MarthaStewart.com looking at articles about what to do with your butler's pantry.
Yeah.
Which I did this morning over a cup of tea.
Or watching like, 10,000 cat videos on Instagram.
What if we were living in a house that had a butler's pantry?
What would we do with it?
What would we do with it? Lots of answers on MarthaStewart.com.
Oh, I'm sure. She's done the work. So. She's done the research. Answering the hard questions.
I would be, personally, I think, a really good butler.
You would.
I would be like Anthony Hopkins in Remains of the Day, or Mr. Carson, or Lurch. Like, I'm thinking of, like, three people all combined. And I think I'd pick a high quality butler. Mm. Ain't nobody would get in that house. I know that.
You would terrorize the staff.
I'd open that door. And you are.
With your demands.
Is the lady of the house expecting you? Do you have an appointment? No? Good day.
I said good day.
Shut the door in there. It'd be like a man, whoever employed me, there'd be security from interlopers.
Yeah, you're such a tough guy.
No, I just can close the door in a face.
Okay.
No, I didn't say it was tough. I'm not going to beat anybody up.
No, because you are not.
Please. I'm Ferdinand the Bull, if anything. Like, But I know what I got, and I can use it.
Sure.
And I can close the door to face. Remains of the Day's on the TCM streaming service right now.
Uh-huh.
And I was, like, tempted to watch it the other night, because I was home by myself. And then I was like, yeah, no, I'm going to watch The Wild One instead. I'd never seen The Wild One.
I've never seen all of it. I've just sort of seen the famous
bits. No, you've seen the famous bits. Yeah. Everybody knows the famous bits of The Wild One.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it's 80 minutes? Sure, I'll watch that.
Kick rocks, Remains of the Day.
Yeah. It's been I saw Remains of the Day in the theater when it came out.
Me too. Not since, probably.
I got asked out on a date to that movie.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was a first date.
Someone knew what your catnip would be.
Oh, yeah. No. We were, it was this dude I met at the Eagle. I've told you about him. Christopher, the lacrosse player. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
I've lived in his shadow for decades now.
Let me tell you what. You have nothing to worry about. The memory of that is fraught and weird.
Mm.
Nothing that I'm longing for. I mean, he was a wall of beef, but like, other than that, that's so are you in your own way. We met at the, what was the dumb bar in Dallas?
You'll have to be more specific.
There's a lot of them.
Wave.
There were, and there
Moby
are.
Moby Dicks.
The what? The Wave. What's that?
What are they called? The Wave?
I don't know.
What was the... No, The Brick.
The Brick. That's what it was. It was The Brick. I met him at The Brick.
But The Brick had like a... Wasn't there like a pool next... A bar next to it that had a pool and it was called The Wave?
Oh, I don't know.
Hmm.
I don't know. I never went to that one. Okay. So I met him at The Brick. He calls me the next day,
mm-hmm.
and he goes, do you like art house films? And
I said,
that's his first question.
Quit selling.
And I go, I'm sorry, you're a big lummox of a lacrosse player, and you want to take me to an art house film? Like, we're getting married.
Narrator, they did not
We did not get married. We didn't last. How long did we not last? 3 months,
mm-hmm.
as an entity, right? And then he dumped me. The nerve,
the cheek.
Yeah,
you were not art house bro enough for him, clearly.
Actually, I was a little too much of one.
I'm sure you were.
Yeah,
you're too much of one for me.
So, Anyway, that was our first date. Made us both real horny.
All that repression?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I watched The Wild One. I need to find out information. It made me want to go do homework. Mm. I need to go find out information about what happened to the sales of Levi's 501 jeans after that movie came out. I need to know the answer to that.
I think they were already pretty popular in the
probably,
1950s.
But
I want to know how many times Tom of Finland saw that movie.
Also, yeah. So Mr. Tom himself saw that movie. I guarantee you that. The pants on Marlon Brando. That, honestly, you don't have to even... You can watch it on mute if you'd like. All you have to do is look at Marlon Brando in the way he packs himself into those jeans. It's nuts.
Well, you know what? You have inadvertently did research for a movie I just saw the trailer for.
Yeah, what?
Called The Bike Riders.
Mm, yeah.
About, like, early motorcycle gangs with... Tom Hardy and, why do I always forget his name?
Oh, my movie boyfriend.
Our movie boyfriend, Tom Hardy.
Good movie boyfriend. Not my garbage movie boyfriend, which is Jerry B.
Yes. Austin Butler.
Oh, yeah, what about him?
He's the younger biker that Tom Hardy takes under his wing. And the whole trailer, I'm like, kiss.
Yeah,
Austin Butler is looking real cute in this, and Tom Hardy's looking real Tom Hardy.
Sure, I don't know. Austin Butler doesn't mean anything.
Your Austin Butler experience is Elvis and Elvis only,
pretty much. Yeah,
you will be singing a different tune when you finally see Dune Part Two.
No, I've seen him in Dune Part Two.
Yeah,
and he looks like freaky and cool.
Yeah,
so I'm into that. I like that. That's fun. I'm just talking about the thing that film critics should never do is be prurient on mic, which is what we have just been doing for the past 2 minutes.
It's Tom Hardy. I mean, come on.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all bets are off.
He defies all
resistance.
Yeah. So, but I don't have it. I don't feel anything.
I generally don't, but the two of them together, I just look go online and watch the
young,
trailer.
Young pretty people are not interesting.
Watch that trailer and tell me that they are not cruising in this movie.
They might be.
There is that a lot of been,
they might have gone to lunch and be like, you know what we should do?
There's a lot of eyeballing going on.
We should spend this whole film cruising each other and see if the camera picks up on it.
Like Jodie Comer is the top billed one, but it's all about those two.
I see. All right, well, that sounds interesting, I guess. I don't know.
We'll see.
Yeah. We have a lot of other films to discuss.
We do.
And one of them, speaking of prurient, is about wildly horny lesbians.
Yes.
At the gym.
Yes.
It is called Love Lies Bleeding. Now, you and I differed on where the title came from. Has anyone stated definitively where the title comes from? Because I first said, oh yeah, Elton John. And you said, oh, the Thompson twins. And I'm like, wait a second. I don't even know what you're talking about.
I have done zero research on this, so I don't know. But the movie is set...
I'm going to say Elton John.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
That seems likely. But then again, the movie is set during the 80s, so it could be the Thompson twins.
I suppose. Maybe. It's from Rose Glass. Did you watch St. Maude with me? You did, I think, didn't you?
I saw it. I don't know if I saw it with you, but I saw it.
Well, it was a 2019 movie. It streamed in 2020, you know. And at least I think it did. I've been getting my dates. My timetable is all off lately.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to send you a letter. Somebody called us out. I'll send that to you right now.
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
Rose Glass made St. Maude a cool, unsettling, creepy, horror-esque film.
Yeah.
This one stars Kristen Stewart as a young woman. This is the 80s, and it's in New Mexico, so everything's brown. And I know that because I was in New Mexico in the 80s.
You have firsthand knowledge.
Yeah. Kristen Stewart is Lou, and she works at a gym, and she comes from a crime family led by Ed Harris, who looks like what's his face from Rocky Horror in this?
Richard O'Brien.
Yeah, he looks like Richard O'Brien in this movie. And along comes Jackie.
Yes.
Jackie shows up. Jackie is a drifter. She's on the run, on the lam, on the who knows. She's on the road to who knows where.
Hmm.
And she is pumping iron to the ladies.
That was my staff pick on the Nolan nights when we reviewed this.
She shows up and Lou looks at her and says, "Do you like art house films?"
The Tex Avery hearts come out of her eyes.
The tongue on the floor. And so, brushing off her occasional hookup, a girl named Daisy, played by Anna Baryshnikov.
Yes.
Daughter of. Who, by the way, in a really geographically specific physical detail, has been given these mottled brown teeth, which is the result of, and I learned this.
The childhood medication, right?
No. When I lived in eastern New Mexico / west Texas, heavily fluoridated water caused lots of kids' teeth to become spotted brown.
Really?
Yeah.
I had never heard of this.
It's something I noticed when my family moved there. And I was like, what's this about? And I never could figure it out. And finally someone said, oh yeah, fluoride. Lots of heavy, super fluoride and hard water.
Are you sure this wasn't some John Birch Society person saying it?
Oh, you know, it could have been. Maybe I'm wrong. Who would like to take me to Correction Corner? Anyway, it was a thing, definitely. It wasn't just like poverty, although I'm sure that was played into it, but the prevalence of kids with brown teeth in eastern New Mexico and West Texas, not insignificant. Anyway, great little detail. Lou is friends or sisters? I forget. Jenna Malone?
Is her sister. Kristen Stewart's sister. Yeah.
And she has a problematic marriage with Dave Franco. But here comes Jackie. Lou and Jackie get together and they cause mayhem.
Yeah.
And they cause it for a lot of different people. Sometimes it's good mayhem, sometimes it's bad mayhem. But I will tell you something about the mayhem they cause. You are not anticipating where it all winds up at all.
Yeah.
This is a neo-noir film about lust and violence and
restless people without options.
This is the old definition of the word, fantastic circumstances.
Yes.
Right?
Magical realism almost.
Yeah.
You could say.
So anyway, what do you think about it? I don't want to spoil anything.
Yeah,
about this
no.
Because it's so wild.
We're talking around a lot of the craziness. Yeah. It's gripping.
Yeah.
You know, these characters are really vivid, even if you aren't necessarily, like, we were talking about the on Max Film, the whole idea of like...
Oh, y'all talked about this on Max Film?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, it's not that you're rooting for them, per se.
Oh, I was.
I mean, you're rooting for them to get away and do their own thing.
I'm also rooting for their behavior through most of the film.
But there are moments where like they do some stuff that's kind of like not exactly indefensible, but sort of like,
well, that's the world of the noir, though.
Yeah, exactly.
People are behaving in ways that you are looking at and saying, "Oh no, don't do that."
Yeah.
Don't do that.
But you see why they're driven to these, you know,
and then you
extremes.
Think, "Oh, you know what? Go ahead. Do that.
Do it."
Yeah.
Yeah, no, very, very stylish, very intense. The two lead performances were great. Katie O'Brien, do I know her from something?
I don't know her from anything until now. I think I would have noticed her before. She could crush me with her bare hands.
Iffy and our guest Mallory O'Meara get into a deep. I asked because her body.
Oh, she was in Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Oh, okay.
Quantumania.
Oh yes, I do remember her.
She's
in
on
that
the Mandalorian.
Now.
So all this stuff I've never watched.
Okay.
Yeah.
I asked about it because you know she is this bodybuilder character and her body transforms over the course of the film, and they were sort of giving me the that's when you know right before like bodybuilders right before a competition will sort of like after denying themselves carbs will hit the carbs and then but then they won't drink water, like it's a whole complicated thing, but anyway there are ways for her over the course of the shoot to have like gotten herself to the places that she needs to be for the moments that you know she needs to be there.
I see.
But yeah, she and Kristen Stewart are great, a great amour fou couple.
They're a fun couple.
Yeah. They're in love. They don't rob banks, but they do
think
maybe
other,
even
other
worse
they do
things.
Other things. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I thought it was great. By the way, I looked it up. The gray teeth thing, tetracycline antibiotics in children under the age of 8 or in pregnant mothers.
Huh.
I knew it was a drug thing.
Oh, well, you were right.
What did you think of this movie?
Oh, 100%. All the way. I'm all the way with this movie. I am thrilling. It is my version of just going to the theater and experiencing pure sensation. And also, I just love the grimy filmmaking style.
Yeah.
And there is so much atmosphere.
The cruddy period detail of 1989, 1990.
Yep. And I don't know if anyone is saying this, but I always think that it might come up that people are like, oh, they're just like, you know, treating this world with a sort of like mocking distance.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just tell you, again, someone who was young in that era, in that spot, it's just accurate.
Yeah.
That's all it is, just accurate. I mean, there's also, again, poverty involved, but I knew all about that too. So the lived in quality of the look of the film, while not pleasant, you know, this is basically Detour for bodybuilding lesbians.
I think the Drea, correct me, the Katie O'Brien character is technically bisexual, we could call her.
Oh, well, so is, the character is bisexual? Yeah, I guess you're right, because there is, you're right.
But yes, no, absolutely.
I had forgotten about that part.
It is a queer noir,
so,
for sure.
So so enamored was I of her hooking up with Kristen Stewart that I...
Well, that's the one that matters.
I forgot. That's the one that
exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. That character is bisexual.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway. If it's still in theaters, and I think it is.
I believe so, yeah.
Get yourself out to this one.
Woo!
Get some mozzarella sticks.
The full experience.
Get a grape soda. My favorite movie theater snack. I got a...
that's Dave's idea of wine and cheese.
Oh, God. I got an email about the Met HD Encore series.
Uh-huh.
And is it La Rondine or Rondine? Puccini's.
Oh, I don't know. I knew opera. They were doing La Cenerentola.
No, I know they are, but they're also doing... Oh. I've always heard it as Rondine. Anyway...
You're the opera guy. I don't know.
Yeah, but I don't know how to say anything because I'm stupid. So I got an email about it. I was like, ooh, it's at the Century City AMC, but I don't know if it's in a good house or an uncomfortable seat house. Mm. There's a nice long 15-ish, 20-minute-ish intermission, just like at an actual opera.
Right.
But I don't know.
Why does the Grove not do those?
I wish they did. closer.
Yeah. And it's not like they've
better
got,
for me.
It's not like they've
why aren't they thinking more about me?
Yeah. It's not like they've got fewer screens. They just think that it's like more touristy at the Grove.
Anyway, my favorite thing to eat at the Met HD Opera Encores is mozzarella sticks and grape soda.
Yes. With your pinky sticking right out.
Yeah. That's another thing that's gonna get back in action after the next hip is installed.
More opera in HD.
More opera in HD, more opera in real life. All around, more opera. I should buy the most expensive ticket with my LA opera.
Your credit.
My credit. I've got so much credit. I should get the most expensive ticket and just wear, like, basketball shorts. And
not unprecedented, I'm sure.
No, it's not. Because
even in the founder circle.
Because I've seen some. Are you in the right place? Get ups.
There's probably some basketball shorts in the cookie room.
I'm sorry?
I said there's probably some basketball shorts in the cookie room.
There are not.
Okay.
Nope. There are not.
All right.
You have to. There's a dress code for the cookie room.
Oh, right. That's
true. Didn't I tell you that?
Because, yeah, they didn't tell you that.
They didn't tell me that. They were like, let's go to the cookie room. And I said, okay, let's go. And all the other gentlemen in there are wearing jackets and ties.
For new listeners, the cookie room is where
it's called the founder's room. The real name.
It's the special
free food, free cookies.
Free cookies.
When you go
it's the special place
free
for people
booze when you go
who give like six figure annual grants.
The minimum gift to the LA Opera for the cookie room is $100,000 annually. Yeah.
Do I look like the Chubb group of insurance?
I look like some kind of Chubb group, but I was mistaken. My identity was mistaken for a man of means because I was in the fancy seat.
Right.
And she said, oh, I said, you don't understand.
I said, and then you fell into a murder plot.
I said, I'm here because it's a treat.
I'm here for comfort, baby.
For me.
And, I am built for speed.
And I'm not a... I will never be allowed into the cookie room again unless someone comes along and replaces you and they reach out to me again on accident. Then I will lie and say, no, I've never been to the founder's room.
Please. I hear there are cookies.
I hear y'all got some free cookies in there. All right, next movie. To discuss Wicked Little Letters from director Thea Sharrock.
Mm-hmm.
Based on a true story.
Well,
but very, very, very fictionalized version of a true story.
Yeah.
In fact, before I knew it was based on a true story, the first thing I said when I knew it was coming out was, oh, Le Corbeau.
Yeah.
And so you and I sat down and we rewatched Le Corbeau, 1943.
Mm-hmm. Henri Georges Clouzot.
Yeah. And it's on the Criterion Channel, mm-hmm. I think. That's where we watched it again. Now, if y'all have never seen Le Corbeau, get yourself over to the Criterion Channel or to some kind of Blu-ray and watch Le Corbeau.
Yeah.
C-O-R-B-E-A-U. It means The Raven. And it is a movie about a little French village where someone is sending poison pen letters.
Yes.
To all kinds of people in the town. Accusing them of terrible, terrible...
Many dastardly deeds.
Yeah. And the result of this, you know, sort of reign of letter-writing terror is the town just, like, everybody turns on each other.
Yeah.
And it is such a bitter, rancorous film about the worst of human behavior.
Made during the Nazi occupation of France.
Yeah, the Nazis banned it.
Yeah, the Nazis banned it for being demoralizing, but Clouzot made it because that's what was going on at the moment.
Right. So, I don't know if Le Corbeau is based on the incident that took place in this little seaside town in England.
Oh, no idea.
Because that did happen in the 20s, I think.
I believe so.
1920s.
Yeah. That's when the film is set, anyway.
Yes. So this stars Olivia Colman. She plays a repressed middle-aged woman named Edith.
never married, lives, not just lives with her parents, shares a bedroom with her.
Yeah,
parents.
They all sleep in little twin beds in the same bedroom. Her elderly parents, father is this very domineering, terrible person, played by Timothy Spall. Yeah.
Mother's Gemma Jones.
Next door is Jesse Buckley, who is a high-spirited, nonconformist Irish woman.
Yes. With a salty tongue.
With a profane tongue, but delightfully profane.
Yes.
Yes. And we meet Edith in the middle of getting, what would they call it, the 19th letter, I think it says on the title card, which is itself a reference to an English language remake of Le Corbeau called The 13th Letter, yes, which I have not seen.
I have not.
I would like to see that one. But, you know, it's in the 20s. It's just after World War I. And Edith is being tormented by these letters that are full of the most absurd, goofy profanity. Just wild, absurd, nonsense swearing.
The kind of profanity from people who aren't good at it.
Yeah.
Like, there's a film that I like that not a lot of people saw called Demolition with Jake Gyllenhaal. Mm-hmm. I would say it was Jean-Marc Vallée. But anyway, there's a character in the movie who's like his girlfriend's like seventh grade kid who is trying to like incorporate profanity into their, you know, daily language. And Gyllenhaal's always been like, no, you're not there yet.
Yeah.
That's what these letters are like.
Yeah. Just wild nonsense. The kind of swearing that regular people, even the most creatively profane, would not think to say or speak, much less to write, unless they were like drunk, you know. So,
pulled over by the Malibu police, for example.
Exactly. So along comes Anjana Vasan from the very cool British TV show sitcom called We Are Lady Parts.
Yes.
She plays a police officer.
A female police officer
named Gladys Moss, and she constantly refers to herself as woman police officer Gladys Moss. When she's introducing herself to people, she says, "Hello, woman police officer Gladys Moss." She is trying to figure out who's doing this, and it leads her on a private investigation because the men in the police station are like, no, you just get us our tea. You don't investigate things.
Obviously, Jesse Buckley wrote these letters.
Because she's bad.
She's bad and poor, Edith.
She's poor. She's a single mother. She had the kid out of wedlock. Yeah. She lives with a man.
And if I can interject, she lives with a black man, which no one in the movie mentions, which means we're in Bridgerton. Because
we are in Bridgerton for more than that reason.
Yes. I was saying,
would you
also,
like me to explain
woman
why?
Police officer Moss also is South Asian.
Yes.
Never mentioned.
This is a film that is about misogyny and pointedly not about racism.
Right.
The fact that it is a film that is cast with people of all races, and no one ever talks about it in crazily racist 1920s Britain.
Exactly.
Is an odd, you know, thing, but you go with it because the movie is not about that.
Right.
They decided, well, we want to cast these actors, and none of the real life details involve anyone other than white people. All of the mayhem in real life was because of white people.
Right. Lolly Adefope from Shrill plays a postmistress.
So that's, I mean, make of it what you will, that the film pointedly, again, refuses to discuss race. It's got misogyny on its mind, and that's all.
Absolutely. No, they chose their lane, and that's what they're going to do.
But so anyway, Rose, Jesse Buckley, is the accused person, but there's no real evidence that she did any of it, other than that she will not behave herself properly in public.
And she's had some conflicts with Edith.
Yes. So it's a cozy mystery, and then it's not one, because about halfway through they tell you who's doing it.
And by which time everyone in the audience
But you've already guessed, you've already figured out who's doing it, and And then it becomes about something else.
Yeah.
It becomes about the misogyny in the culture. And it's also a comedy that is frequently very funny.
Mm-hmm.
But the what is funny is the performances. The people on screen, the actors, Anjana Vasan and Jesse Buckley and
Olivia Colman.
And the supporting characters like Eileen Atkins and folks like that, they are all taking this material that's fine and kicking it up.
Yeah, they are holding it over their heads.
Yeah. So it's a weirdly uneven film tonally because in the midst of the comedy, they will detour hard left into some really
pathos,
really ugly instances of the abuse that Edith is dealing with at home from her father, and this is lifelong abuse. And so you know it's cozy and bright and funny, and then it's dark,
right?
And you don't know what to make of it sometimes. It wants to keep its distance from most of it until it decides not to. There's some heartwarming stuff near the end that makes me think, what's why are you doing this?
Yeah, you know? It is a mix of things, and I think a lot of it, films like this very often, I think, attract people for certain things that are sort of extracurricular.
Period detail, performances.
Yeah, exactly.
From the actors you really like.
Right, and if you want to see these actors do their thing, you will get that, you know, and that's enough of it, you know.
Right.
I know a lot of people who, if they know it's a British movie that's set, you know, before or during World War II, they're there for, like, you know, the lamps and the handbags and the tea sets. And this is not that movie. These are all, like, working class people.
Right, but it still looks good anyway.
Well, sure.
Yeah. It's very tidy.
By all means.
Poverty.
Yeah.
So why am I recommending it anyway? Because of those actors.
Yeah, yeah.
They're so wonderful bouncing off each other. They can make you forget the parts that are not living up to their efforts. Yeah. They are consistently
funny. They deliver.
Funny.
Even
they
the
really
movie,
do.
The movie frequently doesn't.
Yeah. So anyway, there's that one.
Yeah.
Next up. Let me scroll down my list here. What is the next film that we're going to talk about?
Wicked Little Letters goes in the category that Christy and I would always go to call, like, Take Your Mom. It's a Take Your Mom movie.
Oh, this is absolutely the kind of movie I would have taken my mother to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. We saw so many of these kinds of movies together. And invariably, we'd leave and she'd go, that was cute.
Her highest praise.
Yeah, that was cute. Let me go have lunch. Good Saturday afternoons with Mom.
But you'll go see those movies on your own. I remember.
Oh, I'll take Chris is what I'll take.
Y'all were thrilled when Ladies in Lavender came out.
My friend Chris and I, all I have to do is text him, it's Maggie Smith Day.
Yeah.
And he'll be like, ooh, what are we seeing? Like, that's...
Or Judi Dench.
Or Judi Dench, or name... Yeah, or Eileen Atkins, or you know, she's not in movies anymore, but Joan Plowright was always in those kinds of things. If it's got some hats, we're there. All right, Immaculate.
Ooh,
why don't you talk about this? But Alonso Duralde, I love you so much, and I love going to the movies with you. I always tell people my very favorite thing in this world is on a day off from doing this, which is our actual job.
Right.
I just want to go see another movie with you.
Well, you want to see a horror movie with me because
especially want to see a horror movie.
I amuse
with
you. I'm a clown. I did not walk out of Immaculate the way I did with Talk to Me.
I'll never be able to apologize enough for taking you to talk to me.
You didn't know.
But I didn't know. And you dear man, you had to leave. Talk to me because it was too much.
But there were moments of Immaculate that I had to watch through splayed fingers. And
A lot of them, really.
A couple. But the thing is, like, the thing in horror movies that I'm most squicked out by is not, like, you know, demonic possession or something. It's like someone's fingernail coming off.
Which does happen in this movie.
Yeah. It's like the thing that I had the hardest time watching in Jackass was when they gave themselves paper cuts on their tongues with envelopes.
Right.
You know, it's just
right.
Like, yeah, because I don't know what demonic possession feels like, but boy, howdy, do I have a hunch of what that feels like. You know? So, Sydney Sweeney.
Everybody's favorite, Sydney Sweeney.
Yes, who was forced into this movie by the woke mob. Well,
hang on, we're going to get to that.
Yes,
the marketing. Just talk about what
so
it is.
Good. Okay, yeah, yeah. Sydney Sweeney stars as a young American woman who travels to Italy to take her vows and join a convent. And it's
now. It's 2020, whatever.
Yeah, it is right now.
It is, and there's apparently in Italy, there are no shortage of nuns. And no shortage of young women who want to become nuns.
Yeah, they're just
the
coming out of the
numbers in the U.S. are dwindling from what I hear. But I don't know if this is global, and I don't know if Italy is immune from it.
It is mostly global, but maybe Italy is. Who knows?
Yeah.
In any event, she gets there. It's a packed house, and it's a convent where old nuns go to die.
Yes.
So they do a lot of, you know, sort of shepherding their sisters through their final days.
Yes.
Some of them, you know, are maybe, you know, leaping out of bed and saying things that are nutty. In any event, she tries to acclimate herself, but soon discovers, dun, 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 she is with child.
How?
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 Because, as the title of the film suggests, she is immaculate.
Yeah.
OMG, it's a miracle. Great news, right? Wrong. And as things progress, you know, she learns more and more about just what's going on and why. And, of course, you know, must fend for herself against larger forces. You know, this is a Catholic horror movie, which is a well-regarded subgenre at this point. This is not a sexy nun movie, which is a different subgenre.
That's Benedetta.
Yes.
Yeah.
Although the two would make a great double feature. Yeah.
I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a Catholic horror movie. And Sydney Sweeney is a GD movie star.
Oh, for sure.
She just...
She's giving and giving in this film.
Yeah. She is called on to do a lot. She delivers a lot. And she's also one of the prime motors as to how this thing even happened.
Because
apparently, about a decade ago, she auditioned for the movie. It didn't happen. And so
the film did not get made.
Yes. Yeah. The production was stalled in development. And once she started racking up clout... you know, including apparently making movies like Madam Web, which for whatever else it accomplished, got her some good connections, you know,
right.
Plus Euphoria, plus, you know, Anyone But You, all the stuff she's been doing. She like, you know, got worked with the screenwriter to sort of like, you know, get it ready to go, found the director, is a producer on this film, you know, and that is what makes the response in some corners all the more hilarious.
Yes. Would you like me to read?
Yes. Neon, the distributor, brilliantly took a tweet about this movie.
More than one tweet.
More than one, but this one specifically, and turned it into like an online ad for the film.
There are
and
two of them that they made, two online ads. One of them says, Libs. it's the best. I love being called a lib more than anything. If
it's better than commie, even.
I would love a commie is cute and hilarious. My oldest brother has an affinity for the word commie.
Oh boy!
Yeah. Like, you don't even know what a commie is if you think regular warm milk liberals are commies. So anyway, libs saw how the anti-woke crowd embraced Sydney Sweeney as their new darling, and right away had to shove her into this blasphemous, satanic, feminist, pro-abortion, anti-life movie, degrading Christians! Exclamation point. This movie also debases Mary, mother of the Christ! Exclamation point. Aurora Faced, yes, is the account.
They
on
took
Twitter.
Their account down after this ad went viral.
But, so they took that quote and they slapped it on an ad.
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea that somehow in about the 3 weeks or so, that
3 weeks since the
between
time
between Sydney Sweeney being on Saturday Night Live, partially to promote this movie, I would imagine, and the release of this movie, libs shoved her into this film.
They shot it,
edited it.
They took her down the stony end.
Yeah.
She never wanted to go. Down the stony end. They made her, those libs.
It's like, could it be the anti-woke crowd backed the wrong horse on this one?
Want to hear the other ad?
Please.
Diabolical, sacrilegious, purely evil, and grossly offensive. It is profane and has a third act that spits in the face of all that is holy. Just evil. That's from Carrion Cauldron at, I guess, Twitter? Yeah. Who knows? But see, that's also the other ad.
You can't buy blurbs
you
like
cannot.
That.
The minute I'll tell you, I was on the fence about going to this because I was like, Catholic horror movies. Like, I know
whatever.
I know what this is. And guess what? I did not know what this
was. Not yeah.
And I did not know where it was going. And that and these ads made me think, oh well, if you hate it, then I guess I'm going.
Yeah, top of the list.
We went last week on a Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. breakfast. And we were alone in the theater with the exception of one other woman, like three rows behind us. And I had the best time watching you do this. Hold your fingers in front of your eyes.
No, and I'm not a horror person.
Get, the jump scares, which... The jump scares were fine, but they always get you, and I love that.
After the first couple, I knew it was coming,
and I just held up my hand like, here it comes. And you were like, yeah, I know. And I was like, okay, good.
After the first couple, when I could sense everything, I was like, okay, just breathe. It's going to happen. Let it go, you know.
I'm not going to talk about what happens in the third act. But what happens in the third act is a slam dunk.
Yeah.
And I never saw any of that coming. And it is all of the things that the upset people say it is.
Yes.
It is absolutely blasphemous. And if you are a practicing Catholic who is devout and reverent and you also think you like horror movies, but you draw the line at that kind of thing, then you don't want to
this
go see this
line,
movie.
Yeah.
I am telling you right now, this is perhaps the line that you don't want to cross.
That said, this movie has the courage of its convictions.
Oh, sure.
Yes,
it does.
So often, people will say, oh, well, how can you compare, this important Sirioso movie to this, dumb popcorn movie? And I'm always about, what did they aim for and where do they hit?
Yep.
And this movie, sets up a lot and then hits it and goes there and follows up on everything it threatens / promises. And I really admire that level of chutzpah.
There are three other young women in this film who are, nuns, young nuns.
Novitiates.
In various stages of distress.
Yeah.
Played by Julia Heathfield DiRenzi, Benedetta Porcaroli, and Simona Tabasco. And all three of them are going, knocking it out. And Sydney Sweeney, again, in the third act, does some stuff on camera that had me, pinned by the neck to my chair. She is, as you said, a GD movie star. There's also one line of dialogue that she delivers that had me I burst out laughing.
So good.
I honestly can't recommend this highly enough.
I had a great time.
Yeah.
Even when I was squirming, I had a great time.
Next, Late Night with the Devil.
Mm.
Another horror film.
Another horror film.
That is a whole different ballgame
yeah.
than Immaculate. So it is from filmmakers Colin and Cameron Cairn, mm-hmm. or Cairns. I don't know how to say their last name. It stars David Dastmalchian, Laura Gordon, and a bunch of other people who are new to me.
I think this was mostly made in New Zealand, I want to say.
New Zealand or Australia, cannot remember which one. But it's, you know...
Special shout out to Reese O'Terry, who plays the Ed McMahon, Hank Kingsley character here.
It's set on a talk show in the 1970s, and the entire film is framed as the found footage, or the surviving footage of... Infamous live broadcast that took place on Halloween in 1977, when apparently... the actual devil showed up for this very brown and gold 1970s talk show. It is meant to be a horror comedy, but it is, for me, really a sort of creepy, unsettling film. Like, nothing frightened me in it. I wasn't scared of it.
Right.
I didn't leave it feeling... like, upset, you know? Like, I am of the opinion that a really great horror movie should leave you feeling horrible.
Oh, yeah.
Or uneased.
Yeah.
You know?
It should not provide the catharsis that...
I don't like a catharsis.
Yeah.
You know? I like a movie, a horror movie to end with...
it's still out there.
It's still out there, yeah.
And on the car door they found a bloody hook!
Right. So this film has fun with that idea. Yeah. And so while it doesn't leave you with that sense of, you know, misery,
yeah.
What it does along the way is super entertaining.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about plot details, because as they unfold, expect them to be happening.
Yeah.
But the filmmakers have really got a handle on this, the look of this.
Yeah.
They've studied this era.
Oh, for sure.
In a way that that I really appreciate in terms of period detail.
The idea this
particularly
is
on the kind of budget that I'm sure it must have cost.
Sure. Yeah, this is supposed to be a show that was like trying to catch up to the Tonight Show, to Johnny Carson in ratings. And so you get those, like, those we'll be right back bumpers with the sort of like Halloween graphics on it, of very much of the period.
Yeah.
The men's suits.
Yeah.
The studio audience outfits.
Yeah.
Like everything. Like so much of that detail is so, you know, like there was never a thing that took me out of it. Like, you know, there were no like bad wigs or anything that sort of, you know, I found distracting. I like this movie a lot, and I think it's really clever, and I think it pretty much delivers on it. If there's one thing I think that it could have benefited from another draft or two, because it is trying to be both, here's the last broadcast of this show,
right,
but also for some reason there's a camera backstage recording conversations during the commercial breaks. And
well, they talk about it at the beginning of the movie. They've got extra footage,
right? But it still it didn't seem plausible that that would be happening.
Okay, sure. You're right, yeah. But they do explain why
they do
that's
explain
happening.
It. But right. But you know, I just kind of felt like if, for example, there had been like some 60 Minutes type show was doing a segment or something, and there was an excuse for it, because what this movie reminded me of a great deal is a film that I bring up with some frequency, an early 80s TV movie called Special Bulletin.
Yes.
which is one of the first things that Zwick and Herskovitz did before, like, creating 30-something and, you know, becoming filmmakers themselves. And the premise is you are watching a nuclear terrorism incident unfold entirely as it was being covered by network news. So when the time comes to hear from the terrorists who were like demanding that, you know, the military hand them these detonators and stuff, they happen to have taken hostage a cameraman from a local TV station who was covering a dock strike.
Right.
And so he and a cameraman are on that boat, and so the network news can throw to him, and that's how we see that. And like all the backstory we get is the kind of like pulled footage and, you know, whatever that you would see on a real network news show. So I have high standards for this kind of, it's a real thing you're watching, you know, premise, you know, to have a movie shaped like that. And I'd say this movie does it about 90 to 95% right. It's just that last bit where I was like, oh, so close. But nonetheless, very effective and very creepy. And David Dastmalchian, you may remember him from The Suicide Squad, where he was the polka dot man.
Dastmalchian or Dastmalchian?
I think it's Dastmalchian.
Okay.
He's been popping up in a lot of stuff in the last few years.
And he's pretty cool, yeah.
He's a terrific character actor, yeah. And this is a great lead where this guy is, you see the sort of glib on-camera persona, but then you also see the other stuff that's being tamped
down.
As
he begins to unravel,
yeah.
you realize that he's got, you know, an emotional investment in what's happening all around him. And also he has secrets.
Yes, there's a darkness going on.
That might somehow, you know,
factor into all of it.
Yeah. No, I dig this a lot.
Yes, it's very
good. And it's currently in theaters still, but it will be streaming
on Shudder.
April 19th.
Yes.
Is what the date I have. I assume that's still the date.
I believe so, yes.
You should see this in a theater if you can. It's very cool.
But weirdly enough, I think on your home screen, because it is...
It's a TV show.
A TV show. Yeah. I think it'll still work.
It'll work there, too. But, you know, I like these kind of things in the theater. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about... Finally, I have finally gotten us around to talking about The Taste of Things. The latest from a director that we super like, Tran Anh Hung.
Yes.
Who made The Scent of Green Papaya,
Ciclo,
yeah.
Norwegian Wood, mm-hmm. a movie that I loved that I think a lot of people kind of missed,
yeah.
based on a Murakami story, the guy whose work was the basis for Drive My Car.
Yeah. So it came out, it opened in December, I want to say.
It had like an Oscar release,
yeah.
and then I think it opened in February for reasons. Yeah.
And because I was still recovering from the hip surgery, I did not get out to see it. But now it's streaming. You can rent it now.
Yes.
And I cannot recommend this highly enough. Oh my God, I love this so much. It stars Juliette Binoche and Benoit Mejrimel. And they are a cook and her employer.
Yes.
Who is...
A gourmand.
Yeah. This is in 19th century France. And they're more than employer and employee.
Right.
They are also lovers. With a distinct difference than the kind of thing that you would think about when you're talking about a person who has sex with their boss.
Yes.
They have been together for about 20 years, and they have been lovers for about that long. And they have an unusual relationship where she calls the shots.
Yeah. He desperately wants to marry her. And she's
marry her so badly and has always wanted to marry her. And she says to him, very gently, all the time, they're, you know, sometimes when they're eating a meal, sometimes when they're cooking together, because he's always in the kitchen hanging out with her cooking as well. She says to him with some frequency, I like my freedom. I like having my own room. Even when, because she lives on the property, even when he proposes marriage to her, and he's like, well, if we get married, my room will be your room. And she's like, really? I don't know how I feel about that. Like, he must ask her permission in advance, and then he must knock on her door to visit her at night. And if she refuses him, he has to go back to his own room,
right,
and stay there.
No discussion.
So he owns the place, but she runs the place. And because it's Juliette Binoche, you think, yes, this is the natural order of things.
Well, because it's Juliette Binoche, and you can see what she can do in the kitchen.
Yeah, yeah. Now, was it Margie that was telling us that she didn't do any, like, training with anyone else? Because, in her own words, I'm a very good home cook.
Maybe.
I swear that was Margie familiar, that told us that. I don't remember. Our friend Margie. So here's what happens. They cook, and then they cook some more.
Mm-hmm.
In fact,
and they eat.
You might forget that this is not just a beautiful, gentle, quiet film where everything looks nice and people eat nice food. This is an audacious film, because it is strictly focused on two things: on the relationship between these two people who love each other in their own idiosyncratic way, and food preparation.
Mm.
The first 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'm not joking when I say the first 30 minutes of this film is what appears to be an almost nearly uninterrupted experience of watching these people cook together. It is impeccably choreographed. It's all really happening. They are digging their hands into fish and chicken.
And the water is boiling. The oven is, you know, blazing.
It's going. And about 10 minutes in, I thought to myself, you had already seen it. About 10, 15 minutes in, I thought, now I feel the way Alonzo felt the time I took him to see the documentary Mana Kamana, which is a film about one thing.
Right.
And about 15 minutes into that one, you said, wait, is this the movie? And I said, yes, it is. That's the movie. And it is, it'll put you in a trance. And Tran Anh Hung is so adept at creating that atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
that atmosphere of tranquility, but one in which you are also just mesmerized by yeah. everything you're watching on screen.
I always think back to that scene in the Scent of Green Papaya, where like you just watch somebody peeling the papaya and then doing like the crisscross cutting of the right. papaya and right. shaving off the top layer, and it he finds a way to turn action into a million micro actions, and you just, even though you're watching something that's very specific and detailed, it becomes riveting. I think, weirdly, if it didn't require you to be in a theater for like 6 hours, this would be a great double feature with Menu Plays Here.
I was thinking about that too. And why not? Why not spend a day watching movies where people are just cooking?
And look, yeah. if someone's going to feed you those dishes while you're watching it, that would be my ideal day the cinema.
It moves at a very leisurely pace. And that is a plus.
Yeah.
I think it is just this beautiful technical achievement. And it's, I'm not going to tell you what happens, because things do happen. It's the, you will not get away with saying nothing happened.
Yeah.
Things happen. And they're deeply emotional.
Yeah.
I'm not going to spoil any more than that, because it is such a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful film. And beautiful films don't have to feel like anything, but this one is so emotionally satisfying as well.
That's the other great thing I think about Tran and Hung's stuff is that it you get mesmerized by the sort of immediate action, but then by the end of it, there is this accumulated emotional wallop that comes in.
It's not just about the pleasure of cooking. It's about older people in love and the ways that they have been in love and what they share together and the things they love to do together and the pleasure they take in each other's company and the way they allow each other to be what they need to be.
It's worth mentioning that Majumel and Minaj have their own history.
Very much worth mentioning.
Which I think plays into like how their performances
were. They were a couple in the 2000s ish.
Apparently it ended acrimoniously.
Yeah, it ended badly. And watching them be together here, I can't speak to them and how they feel about each other.
Sure.
They may have decided, let's see if this can work. You know, starring as lovers.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we've done the homework on this situation. But I can't help but hope, because I'm seeing a film in which I see these two performers being really generous and kind with each other. So I can't help but hope that maybe in real life they came away from it like, yeah, go in peace. You know?
Yeah. If at least just a sort of resolution to, you know, a catharsis, if you will.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
And you, Benoit Majumel, you do right by the next...
By national treasure, Juliette Binoche.
You better do right by global treasure, Juliette Binoche. By the way, are y'all watching Call My Agent on Netflix? It's a show that... It's a French... let's call it a sitcom.
Yeah.
It's not
one camera, no laugh track thing, but it is a comedy. It is the new The Office / Ugly Betty in terms of
spawning. Well, it's not new. It's from 2016.
Okay. Well, yeah. It is the current Office / Ugly Betty in terms of spawning international remakes.
Oh, yeah. There's like seven or eight of them in all these other different countries. Yeah. But so what happens on Call My Agent? Again, there are four seasons. They're on Netflix. Each season is six episodes long. We love it. And we're in the middle of season three right now.
Yeah.
It's a show about a talent agency in Paris, and their celebrity clients. And the celebrity clients are played by real French movie stars.
Yeah.
And so at the end of season two, Juliette Binoche is the guest star as herself.
And is very game.
And she's she's having a good time.
Yeah.
And it's set at the Cannes Film Festival, so they actually go to the Cannes Film Festival and shoot sort of around the festival.
I think what happened is they probably shot a bunch of exteriors during the festival, and then they were doing their goofiness with that, around it. But it's a lot of fun. She's great in it. But another little plus from this movie.
Yeah.
I don't know if you listened to the episode of Max Film where we talked about David Lynch's Dune, and our guest was Guy Branum.
Yes.
He talked about watching Taste of Others
as
research because he is still working on that U.S. remake of Babette's Feast.
Yeah.
Which just thrills me no end.
Well, if you're going to have somebody write the new Babette's Feast,
it's that
man.
Yes. Do I want a U.S. remake of Babette's Feast? Not necessarily. Do I want it as written by Guy Branum? Right now.
If you've seen Babette's Feast, the taste of things will remind you of it.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Just FYI. And you should have seen Babette's Feast by now. And if you haven't, drop what you're doing and stop this podcast and go watch Babette's Feast.
And I hope people got a chance to see Menu Plaisir when it was on PBS last month.
Now streaming where?
It was streaming for a month last month on PBS.org, and it aired on PBS.
Got it.
I imagine that at some point it will pop up on Canopy with the rest of Frederick Wiseman's documentaries.
Okay.
And when it does, we will bang that gong again because people need to see it.
Yeah. Finally, The Shadowless Tower.
Yes.
Which is a film from Zhang Liu. I believe he's Korean-born. Chinese filmmaker. I know he's had a whole other career before becoming a filmmaker. He's a novelist.
He is a third generation Korean Chinese, according to his IMDb bio.
But again, a novelist.
Yeah, and former teacher of Chinese literature.
And he brings all of that to this film. Now, this is the first film of his that I've seen.
Ditto.
So it makes me want to go back and check out his earlier work. The title refers to the White Pagoda, which is a 13th century temple in Beijing. And it has a very unique design. Well, there's no such thing as very unique, is there? It has a unique design, making its shadow difficult to see.
Somebody in the film says it casts a shadow, but so far away that you won't know that it's connected to it, which is a great metaphor for things.
Everything in life. It did. It gave birth to a saying that its shadow, you can find its shadow 2,000 miles away.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, but what's the movie about? There is a meandering middle-aged food critic. His name is Gu Wentong. He has relationships with his family, with his daughter, with his colleague. He's a food critic. Did I just say that?
You did.
Yes. He's a food critic. And he has a professional relationship that may or may not become something more with his young photographer. And she is sort of always around him, sort of goading him most of the time. He's like in his 40s. She's 20-something, I guess. And the relationships he has all feel like he's keeping them at arm's length as much as he possibly can.
Yeah. His daughter is currently being raised by his sister and her
brother-in-law. Yeah. And we don't know exactly why, but the mother left.
Yeah.
And we find out more about her later in the film. He is also estranged from his sort of long-lost father. He knows where the father is. And he occasionally goes and looks at the father doing stuff. We find out why there is this estrangement. And in that estrangement is a mystery that will never be unraveled. So his relationships are both, you know, again, familial and romantic. And these characters are always rotating around this fixed physical center. The White Pagoda, in very, you know, literary fashion, acts as a symbol.
Fulcrum.
Yeah. And it's a symbolic structure that sort of looms over everything.
Yeah.
In the moment. When Gu Wentong tries to reach out to his absent father, he begins to sort of navigate those circumstances because he, again, we said he's a divorced father who is only sometimes in his 4 or 5-year-old daughter's life.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a film that is about the little details of life. And because of its sort of literary qualities, lots of plot elements mirror each other. You know, there are fathers and daughters, there are fathers and sons, there are romantic relationships. The young photographer colleague, when she wants to irritate the food critic in public, she'll call him daddy so that other people can hear. And he's like, stop doing that to me.
It's about the way that behaviors and responses can carry from parent to child, even if the child isn't aware that they're doing something that the previous generation did the exact same way.
It's also about life in contemporary Beijing as it, you know, contrasts with the way the older characters grew up and their relationship with the city and with China itself.
Right.
So it's about a lot of mundane stuff that happens in daily life as people try to make sense of it all and of themselves and of each other. And they're all just kind of working out their own stuff. Taking into context, you know, the past being a place where mistakes are made and families are broken and friendships sort of wither unless they're maintained. People's patterns of behavior, you see a lot of doubling up in that. So you watch this guy sort of intersecting with all these repeating motifs in a very quietly observational filmmaking style. It is not slow cinema.
No, no.
It is just a very low-key drama about everyday life.
And it's the kind of thing where, you know, you can imagine the sort of mawkish or melodramatic version of this.
Yeah.
Where each reveal or twist is sort of like, you know.
Right.
But yeah, here it's much more, it unfolds in the way that life does. And people maybe don't reach gigantic conclusions or big life shifts, but there's an accumulation of small ones. Certainly.
Right. I felt almost a sense of calm watching it because it's about all of the things that brought you to where you are.
Mm-hmm.
The things you can change, but maybe you just don't feel like it. What you can, what you won't do. It's really just a beautiful, thoughtful film about the choices people make in life. I worry about movies like this not finding an audience because they're hard to describe.
Right.
And because they lend themselves to, you know, criticism of, well, nothing happens, yeah, right, which we just talked about before. But at the same time, it is not formally demanding.
Right.
It's not a film with a camera. It's just pointing at something
for 15 minutes.
A contentious filmmaking style in this home.
Look, there is some slow cinema that I like.
I know.
You have to
I
catch
know.
Me in the I'm right
not
a, mood.
I'm not accusing you of anything. Of being a Philistine. Sometimes I could accuse you of that, I think.
You better not.
I won't. You know why I won't? Because of love.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And professional respect.
Please.
Please what? No. We might be married, but we are film critics.
Fine.
With very differing approaches to what, you know, cranks us at the cinema.
We both like The Shadowless
Tower. The Shadowless Tower. It is in current art house release. Watch it. Go see it. Find it. I really want you to do that.
Go to Strand Releasing's website and find out if it's coming near you.
Do they tell you that on the Strand site? Do they tell you what cities it's in?
They should.
If you go to like Cinema Guild and like Grasshopper, they'll tell you right the dates of where that movie's playing. I don't know if Strand does that or not. Strand's a big deal. Strand's
they are.
They might not have time for that kind of business. All right, we got some letters.
We do.
But before we get some letters, I'm going to tell you all about this Patreon we have.
Mm-hmm.
You go to patreon.com/linoleumknife, and you will find lots of other podcasts that Alonzo and I do about various subjects. Old movies. We got one called Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we talk about an old film.
Mm-hmm.
We do a TV podcast where we're currently flabbergasted by Gerard Carmichael's reality show.
As we are meant to be, I think.
We do a food podcast called Linoleum Knife and Fork. We do a, what is Linoleum Nights? It's a show where we talk about anything we want.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's what's happening in the world. Sometimes it's what's happening with us. But each one of these shows is masterful podcasting. And I won't hear any other opinions on the matter. Subscriptions to these various shows begin at $1 per month, all the way up to more dollars per month.
We've been doing this show
for going almost on 14 years.
Yeah. So, you know, we know what we're doing. We're professionals.
Sure.
We're high-ranking amateurs.
We're really good at podcasting.
You guys.
So, yeah, go there and subscribe to something. We're trying to make a living here.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got some letters.
And you'll get more fun stuff to listen to. Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
All right, here we go with letters. I had to pull up. We had to pause and pull them up. Dino says, hello, gentlemen. I wanted to email with a quick correction.
Woo!
We are being taken to Correction Corner.
Dun, dun, dun.
Happy as Lazaro was not a pandemic release and came out in 2018. And we double-checked on this, and you are 100% right. Why did I think it was a...
Because it was a Sundance... it was a Netflix acquisition.
Yes.
And probably had, like, maybe some tiny release for
in my qualifying mind, for Oscars,
but we watched it on Netflix, and so...
In my mind, everything is pandemic now.
Yeah.
Time just folded in on itself. Anyway, Dino, thank you for correcting me on that. He continues, not trying to be a know-it-all... But I felt compelled to point out this error because I first saw the film at a packed fall film festival screening with a very annoying, disrespectful audience.
Boo.
Many of the festival goers, I don't want to name the festival because the audiences are usually respectful, were waxing rhapsodically about a movie they had just seen called Green Book.
Ugh.
So as one can imagine, Alicia Rohrwacher's wonderful film, Paced the Way It Is, was not for them. I was very happy to revisit the film when it was put out on Netflix later that year. Very excited for La Chimera as well. La Chimera, beautiful. Happy, mm-hmm. Happy as Lazaro, beautiful. Watch them both. I have spoken. I said good day.
Watch La Pupille on Disney Plus.
Yeah. Wilson says, we see you, Alonzo Duralde.
Oh?
You dropped an unconscious... and unacknowledged new zoo review reference at Dave during an LK episode, and I don't think you Gen X listeners, and don't think your Gen X listeners didn't notice. And then the theme song was stuck in my head for like an hour. Thanks for that.
Oh, well, apologies. I can't help myself sometimes.
Holly says, I was super underwhelmed by anyone but you. Yeah. Yeah, so were we. I mean, except for the parts where we weren't, you know? She continues, but my 14-year-old niece claimed it to be the best movie she had ever seen. I quickly directed her to 10 Things I Hate About You and My Best Friend's Wedding and others. Thank you, Holly. Teach the children. Julia responded as after we name-dropped her.
Well, we name-dropped her because we wanted a pronunciation check on La Chimera. We instead got a response to Io Capitano.
Yeah, Julia responded to Io Capitano, not La Chimera. She says, expat Italian correspondent reporting, no, sadly, Italy is not any kinder to migrants than any other EU country and actually fares among the worst. Just a last example, a link to an NPR story about Albanian migrants. Mm. She continues, also Italy has about the most right-wing government it has had in 70 years, and that is saying something. Mm. Despite all of this, geography makes Italy easier to reach than other countries, and the mix of social and political instability allows for a certain room to wiggle out of rules, which would not be so easily possible in Norway, I assume.
Right.
Still, thousands of folks drown in the Mediterranean every year with the complicity of right-wing governments who like to sanction the NGOs patrolling the coasts, and the Italian Coast Guard, however competent, can only do so much. It is a sad, horrible story, and one that EU governments have no real interest in addressing. I would have a lot more to say and more links, but of course, this is a movie podcast. Thank you for the shout out. It made me LOL while trying to put my toddler to bed.
Thank you, Julia.
Larry says, who was the third act cameo reveal that you guys were mentioning in Godzilla Kong? All right, well, you guys.
This constitutes a spoiler now.
We're going to do a thing right now that we do sometimes when spoilers have to happen. We're going to say goodbye to you. Because we have nothing else to say other than goodbye to you, other than talk about this spoiler.
Well, I mean, let me run through my usual show stuff real quick.
Show end of show credits.
Go read my stuff at thefilmverdict.com.
And go pre-order his book, Hollywood Pride.
Go pre-order my book, Hollywood Pride. Yeah. The book, the ebook, the audio book. It's all ready to be pre-ordered. The
book.
Exactly. Yeah. You can hear me on Maximum Film, on the Maximum Fun Network, on Breakfast All Day, on YouTube and podcasts, and on Deck the Hallmark. You can follow this show on Apple Podcasts, and if you leave us a 5-star review there, we'll read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places where we stream, including Spotify, iHeartRadio, YouTube Music, Amazon Music, CastBox, Podbean. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us at linoleumcast on Instagram, Blue Sky, and Facebook. And thank you, Blue, as always, for our wonderful theme music. You can see what he's up to at bleu.bandcamp.com. And now we get into spoilers, so turn it off now if you don't want to hear things about Godzilla Kong and about Roadhouse.
All right. But mostly about Godzilla Kong, because no spoiler in Roadhouse means anything.
Well, yeah.
Larry sent us two messages, one about Godzilla Kong, wants to know the third act character reveal. The third act character reveal is, drumroll,
Mothra.
Queen. My queen.
Yes, queen.
And the way she shows up is just this glorious, sparkly dream. An entrance. A movie star entrance. It is so good and so thrilling, and it made me squeal like an 8-year-old child. Yeah, and then she does things. Good helper.
For sure. The best.
Yeah. Larry continues in the next message. Roadhouse, didn't you guys find it subtly and shockingly very dark? Well, yeah. When in the third act you see a blank in the ice chest, suddenly good old Jake Gyllenhaal as our protagonist seems very troubling. How come no one's mentioning this? He's totally psycho.
Well, yeah. The third act pivot in this movie is not one that Patrick Swayze ever did.
That's correct.
Which is basically, oh, I've been trying to keep my complete sociopathy in check this entire movie, but screw it. I'm going to kill everyone.
Right. So, yeah. That's, you know.
What do you that's our do? That's our new, what's his name?
Give me more information.
The character. He's got the same name as the one in Roadhouse. And
oh, I'm supposed to remember the characters' names in Roadhouse? Well, Patrick Swayze is the character's name.
Okay, yes, fine. Dalton, that's it.
Sure, who cares, whatever.
Anyway.
His name is Patrick Swayze, and yes. Jake Gyllenhaal plays Patrick Swayze in this movie.
Jake Gyllenhaal wishes. All right.
He needs some more. He needs a few more puffy shirts,
mm-hmm,
and some pleated trousers.
And a dance belt.
And, exactly.
Are we done here?
Professionally? Maybe.
All right. Well, that's all we got this time, but there's more to come real soon. Until then.
Goodbye.